Do you fear, both of you, that, say, 50 years from now, what will be the state of not only the Poncas, but other tribes? Because other tribes face what you're
They're
facing.
They're in the same state as we are.
They are.
English.
Right. Could it be possible that it would fade away, or what do you see happening?
In my mind's eye, we will be around forever. Our culture is so strong, it reaches beyond anything that we learn outside of that culture. So I think that when we were created, when the Poncas were created, when the Otos and Osages were created and our tongues were split so that we spoke our own language, we were given a gift. That gift is our tradition and our culture, and it has not faltered. We're forgetting some things. We're losing some things. But, you know, you can't take the Ponca out of me. It's there. It's right. A part of my history, my culture, my being. And I think my children have that. They're also Wichita. It's just in you. So as long as it's in you, it's never going to go away.
And in this day and age, I believe that the tribal history of not only the Poncas but others is more embraced maybe by, should I say, white men than ever before. I mean, if the Poncas were going to go away, it would have happened under duress in the 1800s and as they were paraded down here to Oklahoma, and then as you were sent to school, Cynthia, and you were told to forget, and missionaries came in and you were told to forget. Well, now in this age, nobody's telling you to forget.
No.
The climate is much better. Everybody wants you to preserve. Do you get that feeling, Barbara?
I'm not sure that I would go as far as to say everyone wants us to preserve, but certainly we recognize the need to recapture some of those things that are waning in our tribe, the language, some of the culture, to bring some of our children back to the fold and let them feel comfortable and so they can continue our customs. Just things like that. All the tribes that I'm aware of, especially in Oklahoma, are making great strides in preserving language. We realize that we're at risk. We are a high-risk culture. If you think about it, there's 2,600 Poncas in the universe. Once we're gone, there are no more Poncas in the universe.
So that's a concern.
Absolutely.
And it probably will be rare that a pure Ponca comes along anymore.
That's correct.
They're marrying outside.
Well, our culture almost dictates that because we have our clan system, and that keeps us from intermarrying. So you can't marry anyone within your clan, and you have to marry outside with another clan. And eventually you have relationships. If they're related in any way, shape, or form by blood or by clan, you can't marry them. So you have to go outside of your tribe and find another tribal person that's not Ponca to marry, like I did. I found a full-blood Wichita man, and I married him. Because all the Poncas in this day right now, almost all of them are related to
Related. Yeah. I got so many kinfolk, you'd be surprised.
So the inherent in that is a danger, isn't it, of it slipping away. But then you have Indian cultural centers in Oklahoma and other places that are trying to help preserve.
Well, they're preserving it as a museum would preserve it. It's not anything that's tangible that you can just pick up. They'll have, to me, it's like a memory. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a voice of a Ponca speaking, Ponca, but that's like a memory. If you don't really speak it and you're not among the culture itself, all you're doing is getting a hint of what we really are.
Right. So then it is in jeopardy, the Poncas, in 50 years from now, where that goes. And so if there are young people who become strong leaders, we need to preserve the Poncas, that's what it's going to take.
Yes, so. And we have those young people. They're alive and well in White Eagle, Oklahoma, for the most part. But we have a lot of our culture so much intact, and it's evident around our powwow time in August. That's when all of our kids come out. We're all in camp. We're all cooking our traditional foods. We're speaking the language. We're singing our songs that are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old, and it's all good.
When you see these children around, it's real important to you, isn't it?
Absolutely. In our culture, too, we all have Indian names. We're given names at birth or later on. I see these little children now, and no one has my Indian name, but they have mom's Indian name. A couple of those little bitty toddlers, they'll say, Leetaway, it's this little child. It's not my mother. So that's being carried on. Her name is being carried on.
And so what is your Indian name, Cynthia?
Leetaway.
Leetaway?
The Istowe.
I can't even say that, can I?
Istowe. Yeah. It's hard.
Litowe. Mm-hmm. And Barbara, what is your Indian name?
Lizete.
Her name is Lizete, and it's hard.
How did that name come about? Did you name her?
My mother.
Your
named
mother
her.
Named Barbara.
Mm-hmm. She named all my kids.
Is that part of tradition, too, or did it happen because your mother was...
My mother's, how do you say, big wheel in the tribe. She was a very well-respected person. She's one of the elders. She was the one who can dictate to you. Sit down. You sit down.
Is that the way, Barbara, you see your mother here today across the table from you? Was she very strict, very disciplinarian? Or?
I wasn't very strict.
I would say no. No. I have more memories of my grandmother telling me things to do. And see, that's the way it is. The grandparents really tell you what you're supposed to do and not do, and then the parents just kind of reinforce it. So I was getting it from all these other relatives on how to do this and that, because we have so many rules for everything. It's very difficult to be Indian because you have to memorize all these rules.
It's very difficult to be a punk. Boy, is it difficult.
But I wouldn't say my mother was strict.
I couldn't go in front of my father-in-law. I couldn't walk in front of him. I had to go behind him.
Well, no woman can.
Yeah.
That's part
Most
of the culture.
Most women had to go behind them.
A father-in-law, but not your father.
Oh, yeah. Older person.
Any older male?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, older person like my mother. My mother was very strict.
Yeah, my grandmother was very traditional.
Yeah.
My mother's only brother, who is my favorite uncle, his Indian name was Meike. I called him Uncle Meike. My older son is named after him, Meike Ross. My Uncle Meike died of stomach cancer at the age of 38. And I was just a little kid, and that was the year my younger sister was born. But at his funeral, what is our tradition, my grandmother had long hair. She always had long braids, long hair, had it pulled back. And my mother had to help her. You get your hair and you just cut it off with a knife. And then you let your hair just hang down. And it's just a part of that mourning. And she took it even a step further. She took a big knife and she hacked herself. Mm-hmm. You just cut, like up and down. And it's to take away the pain that she's feeling. Because you're feeling this pain, you don't feel it so much here. She mourned for at least 3 years.
Yeah.
Our tradition says that you go into mourning for a year, at least, when someone close to you dies. And it's out of respect for them, and you're not to go to social events, not to powwows and things. Pretty much isolate yourself. That's when you really mourn and get that out of your system.
It's pretty hard.
Your husband, or Barbara's father, say his name again.
Samuel L. Ford Warner.
When did he die?
2007.
How long were you married?
62 years. 62 wonderful years. He gave me three daughters. Three wonderful daughters.
So then did you participate in this mourning like Barbara has just described?
Yeah. I didn't go anyplace for a year. No social gathering, no nothing. It hurts.
You would go to no events of the Poncas or anything?
No.
You would just stay at home?
Yes. It's expected of you, and it's just what you do. And when you suffer a great loss, you don't really want to be social. You need to remember things about that person. You need to go through their things. Of course, we give everything away or burn it after someone dies. But you kind of gather your thoughts and get your strength back up, and you figure out ways to memorialize that person. So it's just a very difficult part of our lives, but, you know, like after a funeral, too, you isolate yourself for 4 days for sure, and that's when you really cry and let it all out. And it's to help bring you back to your sanity because there's so much anguish and pain in the whole funeral process, which for our people, it's 4 days. The day you die is day one, and then you count three more days after that, and we don't inter until the fourth day. During that time, we feed people every day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We stay up with the deceased all night. You never leave them at all. When you go to eat for a while, somebody goes in there to sit with them, but they also bring the deceased a plate of food and water. And then that's taken away and disposed of in a particular way. It's a very difficult process, but it allows for us to really mourn and to, what I say, get that out of your system. I've been to non-Indian funerals, and they tend to hold their tears back. And I think that makes you carry a burden of not being able to grieve properly, whereas we just really allow opportunity for us to mourn in a very hard way, I think.
It's pretty hard.